This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Second Foundation by Isaac Asimov. Read by Scott Brick. Prologue. The First Galactic Empire had endured for tens of thousands of years. It had included all the planets of the galaxy in a centralized rule, sometimes tyrannical, sometimes benevolent, always orderly. Human beings had forgotten that any other form of existence could be. All except Harry Seldon. Harry Seldon was the last great scientist of the First Empire. It was he who brought the science of psychohistory to its full development. Psychohistory was the quintessence of sociology. It was the science of human behavior reduced to mathematical equations. The individual human being is unpredictable. But the reactions of human mobs, Seldon found, could be treated statistically. The larger the mob, the greater the accuracy that could be achieved. And the size of the human masses that Seldon worked with was no less than the population of the galaxy, which in his time was numbered in the quintillions. It was Seldon, then, who foresaw, against all common sense and popular belief, that the brilliant empire which seemed so strong was in a state of irremediable decay and decline. He foresaw, or he solved his equations and interpreted its symbols, which amounts to the same thing, that left to itself, the galaxy would pass through a 30,000-year period of misery and anarchy before a unified government would rise once more. He set about to remedy the situation, to bring about a state of affairs that would restore peace and civilization in a single thousand of years. Carefully, he set up two colonies of scientists that he called foundations. With deliberate intention, he set them up at opposite ends of the galaxy. One foundation was set up in the full daylight of publicity. The existence of the other, the second foundation, was drowned in silence. In Foundation and Foundation and Empire are told the first three centuries of the history of the First Foundation. It began as a small community of encyclopedists lost in the emptiness of the outer periphery of the galaxy. Periodically, it faced a crisis in which the variables of human intercourse, of the social and economic currents of the time, constricted about it. Its freedom to move lay along only one certain line, and when it moved in that direction, a new horizon of development opened before it. All had been planned by Harry Seldon, long dead now. The First Foundation, with its superior science, took over the barbarized planets that surrounded it. It faced the anarchic warlords that broke away from the dying empire and beat them. It faced the remnant of the empire itself under its last strong emperor and its last strong general, and beat it. Then it faced something which Harry Seldon could not foresee, the overwhelming power of a single human being, a mutant. The creature known as the Mule was born with the ability to mold men's emotions and to shape their minds. His bitterest opponents were made into his devoted servants. Armies could not, would not fight him. Before him, the First Foundation fell, and Seldon's schemes lay partly in ruins. There was left the mysterious Second Foundation, the goal of all searches. The Mule must find it to make his conquest of the galaxy complete. The faithful of what was left of the First Foundation must find it for quite another reason. But where was it? That no one knew. This, then, is the story of the search for the Second Foundation. Part 1. Search by the Mule. The Mule. It was after the fall of the First Foundation that the constructive aspects of the Mule's regime took shape. After the definite breakup of the First Galactic Empire, it was he who first presented history with a unified volume of space truly imperial in scope. The earlier commercial empire of the fallen Foundation had been diverse and loosely knit, despite the impalpable backing of the predictions of psychohistory. It was not to be compared with the tightly controlled Union of Worlds under the Mule, particularly during the era of the so-called Search. Encyclopedia Galactica. Footnote. All quotations from the Encyclopedia Galactica here reproduced are taken from the 116th edition published in 1020 Foundation Era by the Encyclopedia Galactica Publishing Company, Terminus, with permission of the publishers. Chapter 1. Two Men and the Mule. There is much more that the Encyclopedia has to say on the subject of the Mule and his empire, but almost all of it is not germane to the issue at immediate hand, and most of it is considerably too dry for our purposes in any case. Mainly the article concerns itself at this point with the economic conditions that led to the rise of the first citizen of the Union, the Mule's official title, and with the economic consequences thereof. If at any time the writer of the article is mildly astonished at the colossal haste with which the Mule rose from nothing to vast dominion in 5 years, he conceals it. If he is further surprised at the sudden cessation of expansion in favor of a 5-year consolidation of territory, he hides the fact. We therefore abandon the Encyclopedia and continue on our own path for our own purposes, and take up the history of the great interregnum between the first and second galactic empires at the end of that 5 years of consolidation. Politically, the Union is quiet. Economically, it is prosperous. Few would care to exchange the peace of the Mule's steady grip for the chaos that had preceded. On the worlds that 5 years previously had known the Foundation, there might be a nostalgic regret, but no more. The Foundation's leaders were dead, where useless, and converted where useful. And of the converted, the most useful was Han Pritcher, now Lieutenant General. In the days of the Foundation, Han Pritcher had been a captain and a member of the underground Democratic Opposition. When the Foundation fell to the Mule without a fight, Pritcher fought the Mule. Until, that is, he was converted. The conversion was not the ordinary one brought on by the power of superior reason. Han Pritcher knew that well enough. He had been changed because the Mule was a mutant with mental powers quite capable of adjusting the conditions of ordinary humans to suit himself. But that satisfied him completely. That was as it should be. The very contentment with the conversion was a prime symptom of it, but Han Pritcher was no longer even curious about the matter. And now that he was returning from his fifth major expedition into the boundlessness of the galaxy outside the Union, it was with something approaching artless joy that the veteran spaceman and intelligence agent considered his approaching audience with the First Citizen. His hard face, gouged out of a dark, grainless wood that did not seem to be capable of smiling without cracking, didn't show it. But the outward indications were unnecessary. The Mule could see the emotions within, down to the smallest, much as an ordinary man could see the twitch of an eyebrow. Pritcher left his air car at the old vice-regal hangars and entered the palace grounds on foot, as was required. He walked 1 mile along the arrowed highway, which was empty and silent. Pritcher knew that over the square miles of palace grounds there was not one guard, not one soldier, not one armed man. The Mule had need of no protection. The Mule was his own best, all-powerful protector. Pritcher's footsteps beat softly in his own ears as the palace reared its gleaming, incredibly light and incredibly strong metallic walls before him in the daring, overblown, near-hectic arches that characterized the architecture of the late empire. It brooded strongly over the empty grounds, over the crowded city on the horizon. Within the palace was that one man, by himself, on whose inhuman mental attributes depended the new aristocracy and the whole structure of the Union. The huge, smooth door swung massively open at the general's approach, and he entered. He stepped onto the wide, sweeping ramp that moved upward under him. He rose swiftly in the noiseless elevator. He stood before the small, plain door of the mule's own room in the highest glitter of the palace spires. It opened. Bael Chanis was young, and Bael Chanis was unconverted. That is, in plainer language, his emotional makeup had been unadjusted by the mule. It remained exactly as it had been formed by the original shape of its heredity and the subsequent modifications of his environment. And that satisfied him, too. At not quite 30, he was in marvelously good odor in the capital. He was handsome and quick-witted, therefore successful in society. He was intelligent and self-possessed, therefore successful with the mule. And he was thoroughly pleased at both successes. And now, for the first time, the mule had summoned him to personal audience. His legs carried him down the long, glittering highway that led tautly to the sponge aluminum spires that had been once the residence of the Viceroy of Calgan, who ruled under the old emperors, and that had been later the residence of the independent princes of Calgan, who ruled in their own name, and that was now the residence of the first citizen of the Union, who ruled over an empire of his own. Chanis hummed softly to himself. He did not doubt what this was all about. The second foundation, naturally. That all-embracing bogey, the mere consideration of which had thrown the mule back from his policy of limitless expansion into static caution. The official term was consolidation. Now there were rumors. You couldn't stop rumors. The mule was to begin the offensive once more. The mule had discovered the whereabouts of the Second Foundation and would attack. The mule had come to an agreement with the Second Foundation and divided the galaxy. The mule had decided the Second Foundation did not exist and would take over all the galaxy. No use listing all the varieties one heard in the anterooms. It was not even the first time such rumors had circulated. But now they seemed to have more body in them, and all the free, expansive souls who thrived on war, military adventure, and political chaos, and withered in times of stability and stagnant peace, were joyful. Bael Chanis was one of these. He did not fear the mysterious Second Foundation. For that matter, he did not fear the mule, and boasted of it. Some, perhaps, who disapproved of one at once so young and so well off, waited darkly for the reckoning with the gay ladies' man who employed his wit openly at the expense of the mule's physical appearance and sequestered life. None dared join him, and few dared laugh. But when nothing happened to him, his reputation rose accordingly. Chanis was improvising words to the tune he was humming. Nonsense words, with the recurrent refrain, Second Foundation threatens the nation and all of creation. He was at the palace. The huge, smooth door swung massively open at his approach, and he entered. He stepped onto the wide, sweeping ramp that moved upward under him. He rose swiftly in the noiseless elevator. He stood before the small, plain door of the mule's own room in the highest glitter of the palace spires. It opened. The man who had no name other than the mule, and no title other than First Citizen, looked out through the one-way transparency of the wall to the light and lofty city on the horizon. In the darkening twilight, the stars were emerging, and not one but owed allegiance to him. He smiled with fleeting bitterness at the thought. The allegiance they owed was to a personality few had ever seen. He was not a man to look at, the mule. Not a man to look at without derision. Not more than 120 pounds was stretched out into his 5'8" length. His limbs were bony stalks that jutted out of his scrawniness in graceless angularity, and his thin face was nearly drowned out by the prominence of a fleshy beak that thrust 3 inches outward. Only his eyes played false with the general farce that was the mule. In their softness, a strange softness for the galaxy's greatest conqueror, sadness was never entirely subdued. In the city was to be found all the gaiety of a luxurious capital on a luxurious world. He might have established his capital on the foundation, the strongest of his now conquered enemies, but it was far out on the very rim of the galaxy. Kalgan, more centrally located, with a long tradition as aristocracy's playground, suited him better, strategically. But in its traditional gaiety, enhanced by unheard-of prosperity, he found no peace. They feared him and obeyed him and perhaps even respected him, from a goodly distance. But who could look at him without contempt? Only those he had converted. And of what value was their artificial loyalty? It lacked flavor. He might have adopted titles and enforced ritual and invented elaborations, but even that would have changed nothing. Better, or at least no worse, to be simply the first citizen, and to hide himself. There was a sudden surge of rebellion within him, strong and brutal. Not a portion of the galaxy must be denied him. For 5 years he had remained silent and buried here on Kalgan because of the eternal, misty, space-ridden menace of the unseen, unheard, unknown Second Foundation. He was 32. Not old, but he felt old. His body, whatever its mutant mental powers, was physically weak. Every star he could see, and every star he couldn't see, it must all be his. Revenge on all. On a humanity of which he wasn't a part. On a galaxy in which he didn't fit. The cool overhead warning light flickered. He could follow the progress of the man who had entered the palace, and simultaneously, as though his mutant sense had been enhanced and sensitized in the lonely twilight, he felt the wash of emotional content touch the fibers of his brain. He recognized the identity without an effort. It was Pritcher. Captain Pritcher of the One Time Foundation. The Captain Pritcher who had been ignored and passed over by the bureaucrats of that decaying government. The Captain Pritcher whose job as petty spy he had wiped out and whom he had lifted from its slime. The Captain Pritcher whom he had made first colonel and then general, whose scope of activity he had made galaxy-wide. The now general Pritcher who was, iron rebel though he began, completely loyal. And yet, with all that, not loyal because of benefits gained, not loyal out of gratitude, not loyal as a fair return, but loyal only through the artifice of conversion. The mule was conscious of that strong, unalterable surface layer of loyalty and love that colored every swirl and eddy of the emotionality of Han Pritcher. The layer he had himself implanted 5 years before. Far underneath there were the original traces of stubborn individuality, impatience of rule, idealism. But even he himself could scarcely detect them any longer. The door behind him opened and he turned. The transparency of the wall faded to opacity, and the purple evening light gave way to the whitely blazing glow of nuclear power. Han Pritcher took the seat indicated. There was neither bowing, nor kneeling, nor the use of honorifics in private audiences with the mule. The mule was merely first citizen. He was addressed as Sir. You sat in his presence, and you could turn your back on him if it so happened that you did. To Han Pritcher, this was all evidence of the sure and confident power of the man. He was warmly satisfied with it. The mule said, "Your final report reached me yesterday. I can't deny that I find it somewhat depressing, Pritcher." The general's eyebrows closed upon each other. "Yes, I imagine so. But I don't see to what other conclusions I could have come. There just isn't any second foundation, sir." And the mule considered and then slowly shook his head, as he had done many a time before. "There's the evidence of Ebling Mies. There is always the evidence of Ebling Mies." It was not a new story. Pritcher said, without qualification, "Mies may have been the greatest psychologist of the Foundation, but he was a baby compared to Harry Seldon. At the time he was investigating Seldon's works, he was under the artificial stimulation of your own brain control. You may have pushed him too far. He might have been wrong. Sir, he must have been wrong." The mule sighed, his lugubrious face thrust forward on its thin stalk of a neck. If only he had lived another minute. He was on the point of telling me where the second foundation was. He knew, I'm telling you. I need not have retreated. I need not have waited and waited. So much time lost. 5 years, gone for nothing. Pritcher could not have been censorious over the weak longing of his rule. His controlled mental makeup forbade that. He was disturbed instead, vaguely uneasy. He said, "But what alternative explanation can there possibly be, sir? 5 times I've gone out. You yourself have plotted the routes, and I've left no asteroid unturned. It was 300 years ago that Harry Seldon of the old empire supposedly established 2 foundations to act as nuclei of a new empire to replace the dying old one. 100 years after Seldon, the first foundation, the one we know so well, was known through all the periphery. 150 years after Seldon, at the time of the last battle with the old empire, it was known throughout the galaxy. And now it's 300 years. And where should this mysterious second be? In no eddy of the galactic stream has it been heard of." Ebling Mies said it kept itself secret. Only secrecy can turn its weakness to strength. Secrecy as deep as this is past possibility without non-existence as well. The mule looked up, large eyes sharp and wary. "No, it does exist." A bony finger pointed sharply. "There is going to be a slight change in tactics." Pritcher frowned. "You plan to leave yourself? I would scarcely advise it." "No, of course not." "You will have to go out once again. One last time. But with another, in joint command." There was a silence, and Pritcher's voice was hard. "Who, sir?" "There's a young man here in Calgan. Bail Channis."
"I've never heard of him, sir."
"No, I imagine not. But he's got an agile mind. He's ambitious. And he's not converted." Pritchard's long jaw trembled for a bare instant. I fail to see the advantage in that. There is one, Pritchard. You're a resourceful and experienced man. You have given me good service. But you are converted. Your motivation is simply an enforced and helpless loyalty to myself. When you lost your native motivations, you lost something, some subtle drive that I cannot possibly replace. I don't feel that, sir, said Pritchard grimly. I recall myself quite well as I was in the days when I was an enemy of yours. I feel none the inferior. Naturally not, and the mule's mouth twitched into a smile. Your judgment in this matter is scarcely objective. This Channis, now, is ambitious for himself. He is completely trustworthy, out of no loyalty but to himself. He knows that it is on my coattails that he rides, and he would do anything to increase my power, that the ride might be long and far, and that the destination might be glorious. If he goes with you, there is just that added push behind his seeking. That push for himself. Then, said Pritchard, still insistent, why not remove my own conversion if you think that will improve me? I can scarcely be mistrusted now. That never, Pritchard. While you are within arm's reach or blaster reach of myself, you will remain firmly held in conversion. If I were to release you this minute, I would be dead the next. The general's nostrils flared. I am hurt that you should think so. I don't mean to hurt you, but it is impossible for you to realize what your feelings would be if free to form themselves along the lines of your natural motivation. The human mind resents control. The ordinary human hypnotist cannot hypnotize a person against his will for that reason. I can, because I'm not a hypnotist. And believe me, Pritchard, the resentment that you cannot show and do not even know you possess is something I wouldn't want to face. Pritchard's head bowed. Futility wrenched him and left him gray and haggard inside. He said with an effort, "But how can you trust this man? I mean, completely, as you can trust me in my conversion." "Well, I suppose I can't entirely. That is why you must go with him." "You see, Pritchard," and the mule buried himself in the large armchair against the soft back of which he looked like an angularly animated toothpick. "If he should stumble on the second foundation, if it should occur to him that an arrangement with them might be more profitable than with me, you understand?" A profoundly satisfied light blazed in Pritchard's eyes. "That is better, sir." "Exactly. But remember, he must have a free rein as far as possible." "Certainly. And, Pritchard, the young man is handsome, pleasant, and extremely charming. Don't let him fool you. He's a dangerous and unscrupulous character. Don't get in his way unless you're prepared to meet him properly. That's all." The mule was alone again. He let the lights die and the wall before him kicked to transparency again. The sky was purple now, and the city was a smudge of light on the horizon. What was it all for? And if he were the master of all there was, what then? Would it really stop men like Pritchard from being straight and tall, self-confident, strong? Would Baal Chanis lose his looks? Would he himself be other than he was? He cursed his doubts. What was he really after? The cool overhead warning light flickered. He could follow the progress of the man who had entered the palace, and almost against his will, he felt the soft wash of emotional content touch the fibers of his brain. He recognized the identity without an effort. It was Chanis. Here the mule saw no uniformity but the primitive diversity of a strong mind, untouched and unmolded except by the manifold disorganizations of the universe. It writhed in floods and waves. There was caution on the surface, a thin, smoothing effect, but with touches of cynical ribaldry in the hidden eddies of it. And underneath there was the strong flow of self-interest and self-love, with a gush of cruel humor here and there, and a deep, still pool of ambition underlying all. The mule felt that he could reach out and dam the current, wrench the pool from its basin and turn it in another course, dry up one flow and begin another. But what of it? If he could bend Chanis's curly head in the profoundest adoration, would that change his own grotesquerie that made him shun the day and love the night? That made him a recluse inside an empire that was unconditionally his? The door behind him opened and he turned. The transparency of the wall faded to opacity, and the darkness gave way to the whitely blazing artifice of nuclear power. Baal Chanis sat down lightly and said, "This is a not quite unexpected honor, sir." The mule rubbed his proboscis with all four fingers at once and sounded a bit irritable in his response. "Why so, young man?" "A hunch, I suppose. Unless I want to admit that I've been listening to rumors."
"Rumors? Which one of the several dozen varieties are you referring to?"
"Those that say a renewal of the galactic offensive is being planned. It is a hope with me that such is true and that I might play an appropriate part."
"Then you think there is a second foundation?"
"Why not? It would make things so much more interesting."
"And you find interest in it as well?"
"Certainly. In the very mystery of it. What better subject could you find for conjecture? The newspaper supplements are full of nothing else lately, which is probably significant. The Cosmos had one of its feature writers compose a weirdy about a world consisting of beings of pure mind. The Second Foundation, you see, who had developed mental force to energies large enough to compete with any known to physical science. Spaceships could be blasted light years away. Planets could be turned out of their orbits."
"Interesting."
"Yes. But do you have any notions on the subject? Do you subscribe to this mind power notion?"
"Galaxy, no. Do you think creatures like that would stay on their own planet?"
"No, sir. I think the Second Foundation remains hidden because it is weaker than we think."
"In that case, I can explain myself very easily. How would you like to head an expedition to locate the Second Foundation?" For a moment, Chanis seemed caught up by the sudden rush of events at just a little greater speed than he was prepared for. His tongue had apparently skidded to a halt in a lengthening silence. The mule said dryly, "Well?" Chanis corrugated his forehead.
"Certainly. But where am I to go? Have you any information available?" General Pritcher will be with you. Then I'm not to head it. Judge for yourself when I'm done. Listen, you're not of the Foundation. You're a native of Caligan, aren't you? Yes. Well then, your knowledge of the Selden plan may be vague. When the First Galactic Empire was falling, Harry Selden and a group of psychohistorians, analyzing the future course of history by mathematical tools no longer available in these degenerate times, set up two foundations, one at each end of the galaxy, in such a way that the economic and sociological forces that were slowly evolving would make them serve as foci for the Second Empire. Harry Selden planned on 1,000 years to accomplish that, and it would have taken 30,000 without the foundations. But he couldn't count on me. I'm a mutant, and I am unpredictable by psychohistory, which can only deal with the average reactions of numbers. Do you understand? Perfectly, sir. But how does that involve me? You'll understand shortly. I intend to unite the galaxy now, and reach Selden's 1,000-year goal in 300. One foundation, the world of physical scientists, is still flourishing under me. Under the prosperity and order of the Union, the nuclear weapons they have developed are capable of dealing with anything in the galaxy. Except, perhaps, the Second Foundation. So I must know more about it. General Pritcher is of the definite opinion that it does not exist at all. I know otherwise. Channis said delicately, "How do you know, sir?" And the mule's words were suddenly liquid indignation. "Because minds under my control have been interfered with. Delicately. Subtly. But not so subtly that I couldn't notice. And these interferences are increasing and hitting valuable men at important times. Do you wonder now that a certain discretion has kept me motionless these years? That is your importance. General Pritcher is the best man left me, so he is no longer safe. Of course, he does not know that, but you are unconverted and therefore not instantly detectable as a mule's man. You may fool the Second Foundation longer than one of my own men would. Perhaps just sufficiently longer. Do you understand?" Yes. But pardon me, sir, if I question you. How are these men of yours disturbed? So that I might detect change in General Pritcher in case any occurs? Are they unconverted again? Do they become disloyal? No. I told you. It was subtle. It's more disturbing than that because it's harder to detect, and sometimes I have to wait before acting, uncertain whether a key man is being normally erratic or has been tampered with. Their loyalty is left intact, but initiative and ingenuity are rubbed out. I'm left with a perfectly normal person, apparently, but one completely useless. In the last year, 6 have been so treated. 6 of my best. A corner of his mouth lifted. They're in charge of training bases now. And my most earnest wishes go with them that no emergencies come up for them to decide upon. Suppose, sir, suppose it were not the Second Foundation. What if it were another, such as yourself? Another mutant? The planning is too careful, too long range. a single man would be in a greater hurry. No, it is a world, and you are to be my weapon against it." Chanice's eyes shone as he said, "I'm delighted at the chance." But the mule caught the sudden emotional upwelling. He said, "Yes. Apparently it occurs to you that you will perform a unique service worthy of a unique reward. Perhaps even that of being my successor." "Quite so. But there are unique punishments too, you know. My emotional gymnastics are not confined to the creation of loyalty alone." And the little smile on his thin lips was grim as Chanice leaped out of his seat in horror. For just an instant, just one flashing instant, Chanice had felt the pang of an overwhelming grief close over him. It had slammed down with a physical pain that had blackened his mind unbearably, and then lifted. Now nothing was left but the strong wash of anger. The mule said, "Anger won't help." "Yes. You're covering it up now, aren't you? But I can see it. So, just remember, that sort of business can be made more intense and kept up. I've killed men by emotional control, and there's no death crueler." He paused. "That's all." The mule was alone again. He let the lights die and the wall before him kicked to transparency again. The sky was black, and the rising body of the galactic lens was spreading its bespanglement across the velvet depths of space. All that haze of nebula was a mass of stars so numerous that they melted one into the other and left nothing but a cloud of light, and all to be his. And now but one last arrangement to make, and he could sleep. First interlude. The Executive Council of the Second Foundation was in session. To us, they are merely voices. Neither the exact scene of the meeting nor the identity of those present are essential at this point. Nor, strictly speaking, can we even consider an exact reproduction of any part of the session, unless we wish to sacrifice completely even the minimum comprehensibility we have a right to expect. We deal here with psychologists, and not merely psychologists. Let us say rather scientists with a psychological orientation. That is, men whose fundamental conception of scientific philosophy is pointed in an entirely different direction from all of the orientations we know. The psychology of scientists brought up among the axioms deduced from the observational habits of physical science has only the vaguest relationship to psychology, which is about as far as I can go in explaining color to a blind man, with myself as blind as the audience. The point being made is that the minds assembled understood thoroughly the workings of each other, not only by general theory, but by the specific application over a long period of these theories to particular individuals. Speech, as known to us, was unnecessary. A fragment of a sentence amounted almost to long-winded redundancy. A gesture, a grunt, the curve of a facial line, even a significantly timed pause yielded informational juice. The liberty is taken, therefore, of freely translating a small portion of the conference into the extremely specific word combinations necessary to minds oriented from childhood to a physical science philosophy, even at the risk of losing the more delicate nuances. There was one voice predominant, and that belonged to the individual known simply as the first speaker. He said, "It is apparently quite definite now as to what stopped the mule in his first mad rush. I can't say that the matter reflects credit upon, well, upon our organization of the situation. Apparently he almost located us by means of the artificially heightened brain energy of what they call a psychologist on the First Foundation. This psychologist was killed just before he could communicate his discovery to the mule. The events leading to that killing were completely fortuitous for all calculations below Phase 3. Suppose you take over." It was the fifth speaker who was indicated by an inflection of the voice. He said in grim nuances, "It is certain that the situation was mishandled. We are, of course, highly vulnerable under mass attack, particularly an attack led by such a mental phenomenon as the mule. Shortly after he first achieved galactic eminence with the conquest of the First Foundation, half a year after, to be exact, he was on Trantor. Within another half year he would have been here, and the odds would have been stupendously against us. 96.3 plus or minus 0.05%, to be exact. We have spent considerable time analyzing the forces that stopped him. We know, of course, what was driving him on so in the first place. The internal ramifications of his physical deformity and mental uniqueness are obvious to all of us. However, it was only through penetration to Phase 3 that we could determine, after the fact, the possibility of his anomalous action in the presence of another human being who had an honest affection for him. And since such an anomalous action would depend upon the presence of such another human being at the appropriate time, to that extent, the whole affair was fortuitous. Our agents are certain that it was a woman that killed the mule's psychologist. A woman for whom the mule felt trust out of sentiment, and whom he therefore did not control mentally, simply because she liked him. Since that event, and for those who want the details, a mathematical treatment of the subject has been drawn up for the Central Library, which warned us, we have held the mule off by unorthodox methods, with which we daily risk Selden's entire scheme of history. That is all." The first speaker paused an instant to allow the individuals assembled to absorb the full implications. He said, "The situation is then highly unstable. With Selden's original scheme bent to the fracture point, and I must emphasize that we have blundered badly in this whole matter, in our horrible lack of foresight, we are faced with an irreversible breakdown of the plan. Time is passing us by. I think there is only one solution left us, and even that is risky. We must allow the mule to find us, in a sense." Another pause, in which he gathered the reactions, then, "I repeat, in a sense." Chapter 2. Two Men Without the Mule. The ship was in near readiness. Nothing lacked but the destination. The mule had suggested a return to Trantor, the world that was the hulk of an incomparable galactic metropolis of the hugest empire mankind had ever known, the dead world that had been capital of all the stars. Pritchard disapproved. It was an old path, sucked dry. He found Bail Chanis in the ship's navigation room. The young man's curly hair was just sufficiently disheveled to allow a single curl to droop over the forehead, as if it had been carefully placed there, and even teeth showed in a smile that matched it. Vaguely, the stiff officer felt himself harden against the other. Chanis's excitement was evident. "Pritchard! It's too far a coincidence." The general said coldly, I'm not aware of the subject of conversation.
Oh. Well, then drag up a chair, old man, and let's get into it. I've been going over your notes. I find them excellent.
How pleasant that you do.
But I'm wondering if you've come to the conclusions I have. Have you ever tried analyzing the problem deductively? I mean, it's all very well to comb the stars at random, and to have done all you did in 5 expeditions is quite a bit of star hopping.
That's obvious.
But have you calculated how long it would take to go through every known world at this rate?
Yes. Several times. Pritchard felt no urge to meet the young man halfway, but there was the importance of filching the other's mind. The other's uncontrolled and hence unpredictable mind.
Well then, suppose we're analytical about it and try to decide just what we're looking for.
The second foundation, said Pritchard grimly.
A foundation of psychologists, corrected Chanis, who are as weak in physical science as the first foundation was weak in psychology.
Well, you're from the first foundation, which I'm not. The implications are probably obvious to you.
We must find a world which rules by virtue of mental skills, and yet which is very backward scientifically.
Is that necessarily so? Questioned Pritchard quietly. Our own union of worlds isn't backward scientifically, even though our ruler owes his strength to his mental powers.
Because he has the skills of the first foundation to draw upon, came the slightly impatient answer. And that is the only such reservoir of knowledge in the galaxy. The second foundation must live among the dry crumbs of the broken galactic empire. There are no pickings there.
So then you postulate mental power sufficient to establish their rule over a group of worlds and physical helplessness as well?
Comparative physical helplessness. Against the decadent neighboring areas, they are competent to defend themselves. Against the resurgent forces of the mule, with his background of a mature nuclear economy, they cannot stand. Else, why is their location so well hidden, both at the start by the founder, Harry Seldon, and now by themselves?
Your own first foundation made no secret of its existence and did not have it made for them when they were an undefended single city on a lonely planet 300 years ago.
The smooth lines of Pritchard's dark face twitched sardonically.
And now that you've finished your deep analysis, would you like a list of all the kingdoms, republics, planet states, and dictatorships of one sort or another in that political wilderness out there that correspond to your description and to several factors besides?
All this has been considered, then?
Chanis lost none of his brashness.
You won't find it here, naturally, but we have a completely worked-out guide to the political units of the opposing periphery.
Really, did you suppose the mule would work entirely hit and miss?
Well then, and the young man's voice rose in a burst of energy, what of the oligarchy of Tazenda?
Pritchard touched his ear thoughtfully.
Tazenda?
Oh, I think I know it.
They're not in the periphery, are they?
It seems to me they're fully a third of the way toward the center of the galaxy.
Yes, what of that?
The records we have place the second foundation at the other end of the galaxy. Space knows it's the only thing we have to go on.
Why talk of Tazenda anyway? Its angular deviation from the first foundation radian is only about 110 to 120 degrees anyway. Nowhere near 180.
There's another point in the records. The second foundation was established at Star's End.
No such region in the galaxy has ever been located.
Because it was a local name, suppressed later for greater secrecy. Or maybe one invented for the purpose by Seldon and his group.
Yet there's some relationship between Star's End and Tazenda, don't you think? A vague similarity in sound? Insufficient. Have you ever been there?
No.
Yet it is mentioned in your records.
Where?
Oh, yes, but that was merely to take on food and water. There was certainly nothing remarkable about the world. Did you land at the ruling planet, the center of government?
I couldn't possibly say.
Janice brooded about it under the other's cold gaze. Then, would you look at the lens with me for a moment?
Certainly.
The lens was perhaps the newest feature of the interstellar cruisers of the day. Actually, it was a complicated computer which could throw on a screen a reproduction of the night sky as seen from any given point of the galaxy. Chanis adjusted the coordinate points and the wall lights of the pilot room were extinguished. In the dim red light at the control board of the lens, Chanis's face glowed ruddily. Pritcher sat in the pilot seat, long legs crossed, face lost in the gloom. Slowly, as the induction period passed, the points of light brightened on the screen. And then they were thick and bright with the generously populated star groupings nearer the galaxy's center. This, explained Chanis, is the winter night sky as seen from Trantor. That is the important point that, as far as I know, has been neglected so far in your search. All intelligent orientation must start from Trantor as zero point. Trantor was the capital of the Galactic Empire, even more so scientifically and culturally than politically. And therefore the significance of any descriptive name should stem, 9 times out of 10, from a Trantorian orientation. You'll remember in this connection that, although Selden was from Helicon, toward the periphery, his group worked on Trantor itself.
What is it you're trying to show me?
Pritchard's level voice plunged icily into the gathering enthusiasm of the other. The map will explain it. Do you see the dark nebula? The shadow of his arm fell upon the screen, which took on the bespanglement of the galaxy. The pointing finger ended on a tiny patch of black that seemed a hole in the speckled fabric of light. The stellographical records call it Pelot's Nebula. Watch it. I'm going to expand the image. Pritcher had watched the phenomenon of lens image expansion before, but he still caught his breath. It was like being at the visiplate of a spaceship storming through a horribly crowded galaxy without entering hyperspace. The stars diverged toward them from a common center, flared outwards and tumbled off the edge of the screen. Single points became double, then globular. Hazy patches dissolved into myriad points, and always that illusion of motion. Chanis spoke through it all. You'll notice that we are moving along the direct line from Trantor to Pelot's Nebula, so that in effect we are still looking at a stellar orientation equivalent to that of Trantor. There is probably a slight error because of the gravitic deviation of light that I haven't the math to calculate for, but I'm sure it can't be significant. The darkness was spreading over the screen. As the rate of magnification slowed, the stars slipped off the four ends of the screen in a regretful leave-taking. At the rims of the growing nebula, the brilliant universe of stars shone abruptly in token for that light which was merely hidden behind the swirling, unradiating atom fragments of sodium and calcium that filled cubic parsecs of space. And Chanis pointed again. This has been called the mouth by the inhabitants of that region of space. And that is significant because it is only from the Trantorian orientation that it looks like a mouth. What he indicated was a rift in the body of the nebula, shaped like a ragged, grinning mouth in profile, outlined by the blazing glory of the starlight with which it was filled. "Follow the mouth," said Chanis.
Follow the mouth toward the gullet as it narrows down to a thin, splintering line of light. Again the screen expanded a trifle until the nebula stretched away from the mouth to block off all the screen but that